I'm going to read from against Gerard de Rivière from the first essay called Samson and Delilah and the Kids. It's a long essay, so I can't read all of it, but I'll read some of the early sections. And this essay came about because there was a book called Congregation, in which various essayists were asked to take a different book of the Old Testament and to write a personal essay about it. So I was asked to write, and I chose the book of Judges because it had the Samson and Delilah story in it. And I thought that I might be able to do something with it. So I wrote this essay in which I bring in all kinds of different texts, including my own experiences, and kind of make a stew out of it. So without further ado, Samson, Delilah, and the Kids. I grew up in the era of the great Jewish lovers, Samson and Delilah, David and Bathsheba, Solomon and Sheba were burning up screens across the land. I never managed to see David and Bathsheba, though I knew the coming attractions by heart, because the movie industry in its wisdom decreed that I was too young for this adulterous tale. Inconsistently, they let me into Samson and Delilah when I was 7. I still remember my excitement when I first saw the poster announcing its imminent arrival in our neighborhood. See Samson battle a lion with his own hands. See Samson tear down the temple of Dagon. See Delilah tame the strong man. I was so crazy about movies that I saw everything connected to them as a promise of happiness. Lobby stills, newspaper ads on the entertainment pages, and especially the 10-foot billboards displayed outside the Commodore, where giants held at bay an encircling, ungrounded chaos of tempting panoramas. My tolerance for celluloid had been built up over the long Saturday matinees that my siblings and I attended regularly, and which included a double feature, 7 cartoons, newsreels, coming attractions, and a Flash Gordon or Hopalong Cassidy serial. Oh, dark, dark, dark amid the blaze of noon, says Milton in Samson Agonistes. By the time we had stumbled onto the streets, sated with the blood of scalped cavalrymen, the highballs served by Veronica Lake, the dynamite set off by a Bugs Bunny and drag, it was already dinner time. We would walk under the elevated train, past the discount stores serving our ghetto in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, past Stevens Bakery, which specialized in white icing, past the fish restaurant with its grotesque lobster tank in the window, past the tough shoeshine boys on the corner, past the synagogue quickly and guiltily because it was Sabbath, and make our way back to the tenement where we lived, debating our favorite scenes all the while. If you ask me what the Bible meant to me as a child, I can tell you it signified 2 things. Those awkwardly drawn comic strips the Brooklyn Eagle would run next to Dick Tracy or Mary Worth each Sunday, Tales from the Scriptures, featuring stern, bearded patriarchs and women with pitchers on their shoulders, and the biblical spectacles we were constantly told cost millions and had casts of thousands. Whatever possessed Hollywood to turn out all those biblical Roman clinkers throughout the 50s? The post-war audience's abandonment of a neorealistic aesthetic for the escapist anodynes of costume bloodshed, the advent of widescreen technologies that cried out for spectacle, the more conservative political mood, the irresistible formula of having one's cake, sin, and eating it too, piety, the collapse of the studio system and its replacement by international package deals all must have contributed to the zenith of this ill-fated genre. Cecil B. DeMille's Samson Delilah, 1949, was one of the first of the post-war biblical spectacles. Watching a VCR tape of it some 35 years later, I am struck by how dioramic and artificial, if entertaining in a kitschy way, it looks now. Its drama as stylized as kabuki. Its sets like an old world's fair made of endless lathe and temporary grandeur. The virtues of the biblical epic, which DeMille had a large hand in shaping, were mainly to be found in art direction, costumes, and special effects. DeMille began in the silent era, and there is an echo of Griffith's Babylonianism in the idol gargoyle Temple of Dagon. Before the dawn of time, intones the narrator in the opening shot, we see clouds and marching feet and are treated to a little lecture about the struggle between tyranny and freedom. Biblical epics tended to be made after both world wars, when America, as, quote, leader of the free world, unquote, had a need to wrap itself in the sanctimonious mantle of previous chosen peoples. Curiously, the word Jew is never mentioned in the DeMille film, nor are the words Hebrew or Israelite. Samson's people are referred to only as Danites, in what may have been nervousness about anti-Semitism during the McCarthy era. Samson Delilah boasted one of those international casts. The star, Hedy Lamarr, spoke Viennese-scented English. Her leading man, Victor Mature, hailed from Kentucky. And all the Philistine opponents of Judeo-Christianity had, in the curious convention of such films, British accents. A DeMille scholar told me, there are DeMille scholars, by the way, that the director had wanted to make Samson Delilah 10 years earlier, but that he couldn't secure the financing. By the time the deal had come together with the actress he wanted, a certain freshness had gone out of Lamarr. She looked bruised by another decade's strain of holding together her glamour. But her worldly, mocking Viennese air had some of Marlene Dietrich's alluring melancholy, especially when it came up against the younger, oafish Victor Mature. It was the old world seducing the new world, yet again. Hetty's basic Delilah costume consisted of a sleeveless halter that stopped just below her breasts, a long skirt, usually with a slit to show off her nice legs, and anachronistically, a pair of pumps as well. After she becomes a bad woman, capitals, she is never seen without a feather duster plume, which she waves around to make her points, and which is color coordinated to match her silver, turquoise, rose, and sapphire gowns. At times, she seems to act mainly with her midriff, midriff eroticism being a staple of these epics, rendered more piquant by the code rule forbidding umbilicus on screen. Or with her eloquent shoulder blades as she leans against a wall, thrusting her breast forward. Even though she seems rather diminutive next to Mature, she is altogether luscious with her upturned nose, saucy gazes, and spit curls. Mature responds with a supercilious sneer, like a country bumpkin who knows they are putting something over on him but isn't sure what, and hopes his cynicism will distract attention from his slowness. It was about this actor that David Thompson wrote, memorably if cruelly, quote, "It is too easy to dismiss Victor Mature, for he surpasses badness. He's a strong man in the land of nine stone weaklings, an incredible concoction of corned beef, husky voice, and brilliantine, a barely concealed sexual advertisement for soiled goods. Remarkably, he is as much himself in the cheerfully meretricious as the potentially serious," unquote. Here, however, he seems bewildered. His eyes look dead when he is called upon to say things like, "You daughter of hell." He wears a green leather jerkin that leaves most of his chest uncovered, and his broad body, by our more stringent Schwarzenegger standards of muscular definition, looks fat. Incidentally, there is nothing in the Bible that says Samson was a brawny, muscular person. Since his strength came from God's spirit inhabiting him, the theological point might have been better made by casting Mickey Rooney or Arnold Stang. Yet by that familiar phenomenon that makes it difficult to picture a story's characters afterward, except in the physical shape of the actors who played them on screen, however miscast they may have been, the pastor prime Lamarr and the stalwart ham Mature will always remain in my imagination the quintessential, the actual Samson and Delilah. As a child, I was a very forgiving moviegoer. If a picture had one or two scenes that excited my imagination, I would simply evacuate the duller parts from consciousness and concentrate on these privileged images, carrying them around like mental slides long afterward and consulting them solacingly in bad moments. Such a scene was the destruction of the Philistine Hall in Samson and Delilah, where the pillars crumbled in sections like gigantic white Tootsie Rolls. For me, Samson was essentially a Superman figure. Just as I would jump off a chair and pretend to fly like the Man of Steel, so I used to play at tying my hands together and ripping the ropes off, eyes closed. I would grit my teeth and fantasize pulling a building down by straining with all my might. I had dreams of toppling Pius XI, breaking everything I hated into rubble, like the newsreels of Bomb Berlin. As it happened, many blocks in Williamsburg already looked that way, torn down to make way for the future Brooklyn-Queens Expressway. I prayed to get back at everyone who had humiliated me in one blow, like poor Samson, the blind giant. Not that I had so many enemies, but every child suffers from powerlessness, bossed around by adults, older brothers, classroom bullies. There was one tormentor, Ronald, big for his age, who used to beat me up after school. I would imagine ways to torture him, a new one each night, like Scheherazade. As I grew older, I began to concoct more subtle revenge fantasies, sometimes even letting my prisoner go. Curiously, this reprieve gave me a greater frisson. I enjoyed the idea of playing cat and mouse with my victim, one day vicious, the next unexpectedly benevolent. Control, restraint, sadism, creativity. I was only a few years from eroticizing this fantasy with a chivalric twist. In sixth grade, I was attracted to a girl with a Roman nose named Felicia, as were all the boys, since she already had the curves of a woman. She was from a better family than ours. Her father was a lawyer, and she carried herself rather haughtily. She thinks she's Cleopatra, or Delilah, we would say behind her back, because she knew all the boys fancied her. Secretly, I imagined myself drawing daily closer to the beautiful Felicia and impressing her with my intelligence. One afternoon, when I tried to make friendly conversation, she ridiculed me, saying that I wore the same clothes, the same ugly sweater, every day. It was true. I had taken no notice of what I had on, and neither apparently had my parents. After she had humiliated me, I began to have dreams in which Felicia would knock on my door, completely naked and defenseless. Someone had stolen her clothing. Not only did I not take advantage of the situation, I would immediately throw a coat or blanket around her shoulders and escort her home. This chaperonage would sometimes take us down dank castle steps in which I would have to protect her honor by sword fight. Never did I ask her for so much as a kiss in payment, though sometimes she would reward me with a feast of kisses. The closeness with which dreams of gallantry and revenge were tangled in my brain must be why, even today, when I remember to act in a polite manner, for instance, giving up my seat to a woman in the bus, and am thanked for being chivalrous, I instantly feel a twinge of guilty conscience. But then I am chronically guilt-ridden about my virtuous side, if you will. "You are always a good boy," my mother told me so often. "You, I never had to worry about." Even as a baby, before I had any choice in the matter, I was good. When my mother was in the maternity ward, when all the other babies were wailing from the air raid sirens, I quietly found her breast. One of my earliest memories from about the age of 4 is of my older brother and younger sister experimenting with matches. "They shouldn't be doing that," I thought. Sure enough, the kitchen curtain caught fire. There was smoke, flames. My mother came home in the nick of time and doused the fire with pots of water. When it was over, she demanded to know what had happened. My brother and sister pointed fingers at each other. "I didn't do anything," I kept telling her. Finally, she said, "I know, Cookie, I know you didn't." The question years later is, why didn't I do anything? Why was I such a goody-goody? Was I good because I chose to be, or because I was too timid, too programmed to do otherwise? There were rewards for being the good boy, but sometimes it came as a mixed blessing. I was both my mother's favorite and the one to whom she paid the least attention because I didn't cause her trouble. By nursery school, I had already developed a reputation for honesty. Philip never lies, my nursery teacher said. My mother, pleased to hear it, nevertheless insisted healthily, every child lies. Not Philip, said this woman, whom I had clearly managed to make fall in love with me. One day, not long thereafter, I was jumping up and down on my parents' bed, using their mattress as a trampoline. I was no angel. I wanted to have a good time, to break the rules, to become an evildoer. In mid-jump, I heard my mother coming. What were you doing? Were you jumping on my bed like I told you not to? No, I protested. I saw you do it, she exclaimed. Don't fib to me. Though I got a beating afterward, we were both relieved. He lies. In Judges, the story of Samson begins with his mother's barrenness. An angel appears to the wife of Manoah and tells her she is going to have a son, but she should drink no wine nor eat anything unclean, and, quote, no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines, unquote. She runs and tells her husband what the stranger has said, and Manoah gets the angel to repeat these instructions a third time. Then a puff of smoke, flames, and the couple realizes that the stranger is indeed an angel of the Lord. They fall on their faces to the ground. This angelic visitation to a barren woman is a recurrent biblical formula. Only in the context of Judges, with its dense narrative style, does the incident's leisurely redundancy surprise? Why is a whole chapter of 25 verses wasted on this business? Certainly no other judge is accorded such preliminary build-up. It is almost as though the whole book of Judges were taking a breath before launching into the Samson story. In a way, also, the chapter lets us know that before Samson is even born, he is in God's debt. His body itself doesn't quite belong to him. It's a sacred weapon for God to inhabit with his spirit when he so desires. Moreover, without any choice in the matter, Samson is pledged to be a Nazarite, one who is consecrated, abstinent, separate from others, pure. No wonder Samson acts bad. He is trying to make a space for his own life inside the one already owed to his parents and God. So he indulges in skirt chasing. All his troubles, but also all his heroic deeds, stem from whoring and womanizing. He falls in love easily, and it seems purely on a physical basis. Like Portnoy, he is drawn to Shiksus. In our very first encounter with the adult Samson, he has just seen a woman in Timnah, the daughter of Philistines, and wants her for a wife. His parents object. Is there not a woman among the daughters of your kinsmen or among all the people that you must go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Now this first time he is exonerated from blame, because the text immediately assures us that Samson's romantic entanglement was the doing of the Lord, who was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Later in the Delilah episode, this cosmic alibi is withdrawn. Samson will be made to stand completely alone with his mistake. Everything in the Samson story happens twice, sometimes thrice. Repetitions establish his character patterns. Thus, if he had only let Delilah wheedle a secret out of him, that would be one thing. But before he does so, he gives the woman of Timnah the answer to his wedding riddle because she pressed him hard. Samson is a man women nag. For all his strength, he seems not to engender their full respect, much less their obedience. They know how to plan his guilt with tears and reproaches. You don't really love me, or you tell me your secret. To twist him around their fingers, and ultimately they betray him. Not only does the woman of Timnah broadcast the riddle secret, forcing Samson to pay everyone the betting price, but she cuckolds Samson by giving herself to his companion, who had been his best man. Delilah does even worse. She ruins him. Sandwiched between these two women is the harlot of Gaza, who also endangers Samson by keeping him occupied while his enemies surround his house. He escapes by lifting the city gates on his shoulders, but he is clearly tempting fate. Samson also is a man who seems to enjoy being self-righteously angry. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle, he tells the wedding guest, kills 30 men, and stomps off in hot anger. Later, when he returns to Timnah and finds his wife has been given to another man, he rejects the offer of marrying her younger sister. This time, he says, I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them mischief. Then he ties 300 foxes together, attaches lit torches between their tails, and lets them burn up all the Philistine orchards and grain. The Philistines retaliate by torching his wife, who had already abandoned him, and her father. Samson retorts, if this is what you do, I swear I'll be avenged upon you, and after that I will quit. And he smote them hip and thigh with great slaughter. The implication is that any destruction, however disproportionate, is justifiable if interpreted as retaliation. No wonder Samson allows himself so often to be betrayed. It frees him to do what he wants. I grew up in a household where there was much arguing and yelling, even hitting. But it was necessary, as we learned from imitating my mother, always to lay a groundwork of self-righteousness before any explosion. I am only doing this to you because you did X and Y to me first. Within the never-ending chain of injured feelings that is family history, it is not always easy to find the beginning of a causal series, which is why the person with the loudest voice or the longest memory is generally able to make the best tit-for-tat. My older brother, Hal, whose voice is very strong, was for a while the undisputed king of righteous explosions. Fortunately, Hal would fulminate so long on the heinousness of the wrong done him that it was possible to get out of the way of any serious physical harm before he swung into action. We were much more terrified of my father, who was phlegmatic, quiet, and withdrawn for the most part. But if he blew up, you had less than a second's warning. When my father got physical, the slaps and punches came hard and fast, as in a street fight. He had powerful bony hands and sharp elbows, and in anger he seemed to lose control, with white spittle foaming at his mouth like a mad dog, or at least that was how it looked to us as children. Curiously, he always tried to get out of spanking us. He had no heart for premeditated disciplining, leaving such beatings to my mother. She would take out her ironing cord, a black and white fabric switch, which we thought of as a live creature. What was interesting about the way she beat us was that she would herself grunt and make awful faces each time she picked up her arm. You had enough, she would demand after each blow. Going to try that again? It was a dialogue. We were supposed to respond correctly so that she would know when to quit. My brother would take his punishment like a man, howling only when he was in pain. I was more of a faker. Very early I caught on that it was all symbolic, and I would scream and carry on from the first hand raise so that she would let me go with next to nothing. My sister Molly, however, would laugh in my mother's face, would giggle or hum a tune to herself, refusing to concede even when I could see tears welling in her eyes, until finally my mother would stop, baffled, her arm exhausted. I am struggling to find the pattern between all these pieces. I have the sense that the Samson story and my family story touch in odd ways. I try to put the stencil of one over the other, and while they occasionally overlap, just as often the connection seems far-fetched. Nonetheless, I am convinced that the center of both is the mystery of power relations between men and women. I start to write, how did it come about that I started mistrusting women or thought they would betray me? But then I pause. Do I really? Aren't I often less guarded around women than I am with men? Well, let us say that a part of me still fears or hopes that women are treacherous creatures. I know that growing up, watching the unhappiness between my parents, watching my mother disparage my father every day and my father refuse to let her go, made me cautious toward the opposite sex. Then, too, my mother was very insecure as a young woman. We would climb into her lap, and she would suddenly push us away, saying, don't start that mommy, I love you crap. You're only being lovey-dovey because you want something out of me. Okay, what is it this time, an ice cream? a quarter. Naturally, I learned to be skeptical of affection, almost to want a barbed hurt to accompany love. As for my father, he had been treated wretchedly by his stepmother, who put him to work all the time, so he was both desperate for maternal warmth and suspicious of any feminine softness. When these two hurt, insecure people, the black sheep of both their middle-class families, came together to live in poverty and raise their own family, the results were not pretty. My parents had a bookcase which held a few hardcovers and a library of pocketbooks, whose flimsy browning pages would crack if you bent down the corners. I can still picture those cellophane peeling covers with their kangaroo logo, their illustrations of busty, available-looking women or hard-bodied men or solemn, sensitive-looking Negroes with titles like Intruder in the Dust, Appointment in Samara, Tobacco Road, Studs Lonergan, Strange Fruit, Good Night, Sweet Prince, The Great Gatsby, The Sound and the Fury. Father brought home all the books. It was his responsibility. Though mother chafed at everything else in the marriage, she still permitted him at the time to be her intellectual mentor. I have often wondered on what basis he made his selections. He'd only had one term of night college, dropping out because he fell asleep in class after a full day in the factory, and I never saw him read book reviews. He seemed all the same to have a nose for decent literature. He was one of those autodidacts of the Depression generation, for whose guidance the inexpensive editions of Everyman, Modern Library, and Pocketbooks seemed intentionally designed out of some bygone assumption that the working man should or must be educated to the best in human thought. My father had an awed respect for the power of good fiction, especially when it was able to mirror uncannily the conflicts in his own life. He would often marvel at Kafka's story, The Judgment, in which the patriarch tells his son to jump off a bridge, obviously because his father, my grandfather, had treated him like dirt. He never stopped praising The Brothers Karamazov, which had the status of the Bible in Brooklyn at the time. Again, I suspect its patricidal theme excited him more than Dostoevsky's philosophy. He did dip into one philosopher, Schopenhauer, and would occasionally read aloud one of the gloomy German's misogynistic aphorisms. These were usually to the effect that women had no capacity for ideas, that their only cleverness was in tricking men to perpetuate the species. My mother gave an odd sort of credence to this theory by boasting that she had seduced my father into siring us, finagling away the contraception, I suppose, since he hadn't really wanted children. 4 times she tricked him? Whether true or not, it was her way of making us feel indebted to her and opposed to him. In any event, Schopenhauer's bon mots were his single means of answering mother's nagging. My father was one of those dependable Jewish working men of his generation who regarded housework or any physical task around the house as anathema. In his case, the phobia may have been increased because of his chore-filled childhood. He would not lift a finger around the house if it killed him, my mother would say. It was she who had to bang the nails, unstick the windows, lay the linoleum, complaining while my father sat, the soul of passivity, reading a book or napping. It enraged her, partly because she had to go to work too, and partly because my father was so able-bodied. As a young man, he was tall, wiry, and very strong, like Samson. In his factory, he could lift huge bales. At carnivals, he would ring the bell. He triumphed at arm wrestling. Yet he became a weakling as soon as he arrived home. His kryptonite was family life. If my mother said something sarcastic to him, like, "Why don't you get off your bony ass and do something?" Or, "What do I need you for? You're not married to me. You're married to your easy chair in the goddamn ball game." He would merely sink deeper into a defeated shrug. But I believe that behind his stoical, resigned mask, there raged a fierce misogyny. What I would call the blue angel of human bondage plot, the educated or sensitive man who is dragged down by a coarse, sluttish vixen, had a peculiar vogue with my father's generation. One of the books he often touted to us was Ludwig Lewison's novel, The Tyranny of Sex. When I was 16 and still a virgin, I read it, naturally, to find out what was in store. Its lumpy, post-Dreiserian naturalist style disappointed me, and I remember feeling the author was weighting the scales a bit too unfairly against the wife. Nevertheless, the luridly compelling story remained with me. A man becomes attracted to a woman, wants to sleep with her, and the next thing he knows, he is married, cuckolded, in debt. His dreams for himself have flown out the window. His wife has become a slattern, no longer even attractive, a nagging shrew. In short, women as swamp, quicksand. Given the atmosphere in my home, I found the Samson Delilah story the most natural in the world. Already I had imbibed from my father his sense of sexuality as a nightmarish tyranny, robbing a man of his strength, just as I had absorbed from my mother a rebellious, defiantly flirtatious, erotic appetite for life. My mother had bought a piano, and she practiced her songs on it, preparing for the far-off day when she would become a professional entertainer. She sang mostly torch songs, the kind Helen Morgan made famous. The man I love, just my bill, I must try to make the man love me, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered, I want a Sunday kind of love. With her pretty, tremulous voice, she would pour all her yearning and disappointment into these bittersweet verses. The message was unmistakable, even to a little kid. She was not happy with my father. She was still looking for something better, for romance. I loved to listen to her practice, glancing over her shoulder at the rising and falling syllables of the sheet music. All day in elementary school, her songs would go around in my head. At recess, I would play tag or punch ball to the rhythms of her longing. One day, when it was too rainy to go outside, the teacher herded us into the auditorium and staged an impromptu talent show. Each child was urged to perform in front of the combined second and third grades. There were rampant cases of stage fright. Some kids started to entertain, then giggled and hid their faces. Others came on and rattled through a comic ditty or radio jingle so fast you couldn't make out the words. I wanted to sing. I faced the group, and hearing my mother's semi-trained voice in my ears, I let her guide me through the melody. Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. I could sense the teachers snickering, trading looks that said, we know how this one's going to turn out. My classmates started laughing. I realized too late that the song was for a girl. They would think me a sissy. I had no choice but to finish. At least I could try to sing on key and with feeling, as my mother did. Maybe if I did, I would seduce them into liking it. When the last contestant was finished, the teachers awarded me first prize, a comic book. I, part Delilah, wondered if I would ever become a real man. And I'll stop here. Thank you.